to tell us whether if you have opposition from anybody that you dispose of them by having them stuffed in a trunk? Is that what you do, Mr. Gene Connor?
Decline to answer because I honestly believe my answer might tend to incriminate.
Will you tell us anything about any of your operations, or you just giggle every time I ask you a question?
Decline to answer because I honestly believe my answer might tend to incriminate.
I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Gene Connor.
The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Welcome back, everyone, to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Wade, along with my co-host, Jaeger Yancey Tedder. Jaeger, say hello.
Hello, everyone. It is a pleasure to be back with you this weekend. Hollywood, how are you feeling tonight?
I'm not too bad. It's been a long, hot day. The sun is really murder, so to speak, which will fit right into our podcast here we're talking about today. How are
last
you feeling?
People heard from you. Well, I'm great. I'm worried about you, though. You were flipping over in cars 17, 18 times, like Reggie Hammond. You had fingers going places. I think you were auditioning to be Candyman. I put a hook on your arm. You don't have to do it. It's fake. It's just a movie.
Definitely a little stiff, a little sore. It's the remnants. I actually sat down and watched the Fast 9 movie, and my son was watching that with me. And that's just went to a whole nother level of unbelievable, but there's a part in there where he runs off a mountain, grabs a hold to a rope with a car, swings to the other side of the mountain, then flips over about four or five times. And then they're just sitting there like, oh, that was new. And my son's like, Dad, you know, they don't seem to be hurt in those wrecks. I was like, yeah, well, I guess it wasn't as bad as mine, I guess.
When you text me and say they went to space,
yes,
all I can do is laugh. That was one of the first things that came out about that movie. I had watched all of it, and when it was in theaters, I heard people just go, oh, they actually went to space.
I thought that was a lie. I thought they were just bullshitting. They actually went to space.
See why they went to space.
I guess
what a week.
There's a point where you ain't got much left to do here on Earth, I guess. We'll just send you on into outer space in a fucking Pontiac Fiero.
Brothers with a hood in space. Oh, goodness gracious. So the movie podcast, I'm glad we got that out of the way.
Yeah, we'll get that part out the door here. But what we're going to do this week, we actually brought back on Red Womet. Now, that was a very popular episode that we did a few episodes back. And we weren't done talking with Red because that man's got a lot of stories. You probably still ain't done talking to him. But on this one here, I mean, we dive back into a few more players from the movie Casino. Frank Lefty Rosenthal, who was played by Robert De Niro's character in there, Ace Rothstein. We talk about Sam Giancana and the Kennedys. Now, that was who you heard in this opener. Sam Giancana was a mob boss of Chicago at the time. Everybody knows that John F. Kennedy, who was assassinated, his brother Robert Kennedy started RICO, which pretty much crippled the mob and crippled, you know, about anything organized crime wise, biker gangs and everything else. They started all that. So that was when they actually had Giancana on the stand, and Giancana kept taking the Fifth Amendment. And so it was getting up under Robert's skin a little bit, and he was pissed off about it. But that's where that is. We talk about Marilyn Monroe, you know, and her death, which the Kennedys are also, you know, accused of being involved in that. We talk about Jimmy Hoffa and his disappearance, Al Capone. I mean, just a fantastic interviewer. That man's got a lot of info, a lot of insider info, because like I said, he was there with the boys. You listened to the last Red We Met episode. Or what'd you think about that, going over to players from Casino?
All that stuff is so informative. Like, it almost feels like you're not supposed to be hearing all this.
It does. I told Red a few times in our conversation, I'm like, Red, you know, you're probably not even really supposed to be alive right now.
Yeah, I don't know if I wanted to come out of the mouth like that, but yeah, basically. This man just shows the stories out so smoothly too, man.
He does. This man up here is hobnobbing with Tony Spilotra and Frank Schweiss and some major players in the underworld here. So I guess
all those names.
Yeah. I mean, you really, if you're into LCN and organized crime and the outfit, you know, these names are going to ring some bells to you. If you're not, they were major players. I mean, Sam Giancana was reportedly attempted and sat down and had a meeting about trying to take out Castro because, see, the U.S., they wanted Castro gone too, but the mob wanted him gone as well because they were making money hand over fist over there in Cuba with the casinos. Right. Meyer Lansky had fronted a bunch of money to open up casinos over there in Cuba. And when Castro went, they basically just took the damn thing over. So they went from making, money by the boatload to not getting shit. So the mob and the U.S. both wanted Castro down. And they had a bunch of plots to do it. Now nothing ever came of it. Obviously Castro lived a pretty good while after that, but they had vested interest in that. And there was, reports and rumors. Obviously I wasn't there, but there's definitely been some documented stuff to back those stories up that they were going to, try to go ahead and take Fidel out. So, I mean, just real interesting stuff here. There's a lot of stuff tied in with the Kennedys, man. I mean, there were some people say they're the sixth mafia family, you could almost say, because I mean, their dad ran bootleg liquor back in the day, pretty much got, JFK in there. And, then obviously Robert, come up with the RICO and put half the mob in jail. So there's a lot of hatred there. Obviously the links to them, having Kennedy killed and, just there's so many rabbit holes you can go down with the Kennedys. And that's just going on.
Let me tell you, that is something else. To have enemies in the mob and the U.S. government. I mean, just think about that for a second. I'm going to talk back to your wife. But good grief, that's a lot of people who want you gone.
I tell you what, Aaron, why don't we just get right on into the episode here. This is part two of our interview with Red Wimette. Here, heard exclusively on Crime and Entertainment. Welcome back, everybody, to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Wade. And again here, we have my good friend Red Wimette with us again. We had some technical difficulties towards the end of the last show, so we'll kind of pick up and go over a few things that we were talking about in case you guys didn't get all that. The first and foremost would be Red does have a book that you can go get, and that's actually, you can get it autographed by him if you go through him. It's available on other avenues, of course. But if you're going to get it, you might as well get it and get his John Hancock on there for it. Red, you want to tell them a little bit about that?
It's the same price as if you ordered someplace else, but it's $19.95, and it's on every, you can get it just about anywhere. But Red Wimette, Red, RedWimette.com is the order page for it.
Right. And that kind of gives a good in-depth look at, all the things that you were involved in, which was a lot. And that was kind of what we covered in our first episode. We concentrated a lot around the true guys from the movie Casino. One of the guys that we didn't talk about very much was actually in the movie. It was Ace Rothstein. In real life, it was Frank Rosenthal. Now, was that pretty true to form? He was a Chicago guy at first. He was out of Chicago down there.
Yes. Actually he'd gone to Miami and, he got thrown out of Miami. They arrested him for gambling charges. And, it was just kind of like they were on, that's all he did was, make book. So, and he was he was good at what he did. Excellent at what he did. But, he went back to Chicago and then they sent him out to Las Vegas.
Wow. Now,
that was a big responsibility being in charge of the Stardust, because the Stardust was like the flagship of everything on the strip at that time.
Right. In the movie, they portray it as the Tangiers, I think it is. But, in real life, like you said, it was the Stardust. Now, and a lot of that is true. He had his own TV show for a little while and everything there.
Oh, yeah. Well, this guy spent money like he didn't care.
Right.
All his life. I met him in Boca Raton when he bought a house in Boca Raton, Florida after Casino, mm-hmm. after the casinos tumbled and everything.
Right.
And he was doing sports betting down there, but he still had his kids with him. He had two more kids. And he waited till they grew up. When Casino came out, the movie, mm-hmm. it was all over TV that it was out. So he called the stations, and they brought all the cameras, every news station there in West Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Went down to Boca Raton,
mm-hmm.
and they interviewed him on his front porch.
Wow.
And he came out just like in the movie. He comes out in a robe and pajamas and slippers, and he's got a cigarette holder, and he's just playing up. He was a ham.
Yeah.
He was a ham.
Now,
and I was standing back behind the news cameras, and I waited till everybody left before I walked up to talk to him. I didn't want, you know, want to get anything crazy. But later on, when he sold the estate, and he went down, he bought a beautiful condo down in Miami, and he was doing offshore betting, and he was a consultant for the Hard Rock Casino Cafe. Mm. So, and then he died.
Right.
But he was a kind of a prima donna. I mean, he was kind of a prima donna. He wasn't, you'd never think he was a street guy.
Right.
And he could never fight his way out of a paper bag. I mean, he wasn't a tough guy.
So that's pretty true to form, because he wasn't really necessarily the muscle as portrayed in the movie. Tony pretty much handled all that. By that, I mean, Tony Spilotro.
And Frank Collada and the rest of those guys. But that was him. That's why they sent him there.
Right.
To take care of him.
Yeah.
I think he said in the movie, God forbid something should happen to the Golden Jew.
know? Yeah. God forbid nobody fucks with the Golden Jew. Yeah. That's what he says. You know, the guy's making a lot of money for us. So, you know, go out there and look out for him and make sure nothing happens to him. Now, his wife, who is portrayed by Sharon Stone in the movie, now, her real name, what was her real name?
Jerry McGee.
Jerry McGee. Okay. Now, was that pretty close? Did Jerry and Tony get together there?
Yeah.
They did?
You gotta know something about Jerry. She was a prostitute, a hooker, and a hustler.
Right.
I mean, she was the hustle guys at the tables. He admitted to a lot of people. He did an article for Rolling Stone magazine, and he said that was the only woman I ever really loved. That once she drove me crazy. He said I just had to have her. And I don't know, it was a strange thing. It was a midlife crisis for him. Right. She was a lot younger,
mm-hmm.
and she was a knockout. She was a real knockout.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of her.
Yeah. She could have been a Playboy centerfold.
Right.
She was really a knockout, but, she had a drug habit, and they all knew this going into it. So, when you know something going into that, when you're smitten by love, you're smitten by love. I guess love is blind.
Yeah. And even in the opening scene, I mean, she's throwing all the guys' chips up in the air, causing a commotion in the casino. And he's just like, he's looking right through all that, looking at nothing but her, like everything else is blurred.
Well, I think that's dramatic of Scorsese, but you know, one thing that she did do a lot of was she sit down next to guys and she'd bring them good luck. And if she brought them good luck and they made money, they would throw her a chip or two.
Right.
Well, sometimes she'd reach in her pocket and grab four or five chips. She was a good pickpocket.
Yeah. Now, when she passed away in the movie, they said that she got hooked up with some bikers and some.
She was always hooked up with those bikers.
Yeah.
And when she went to them, when she left him and went to him, by the way, she never did turn government witness ever.
Right.
She wouldn't talk. Yeah, she wouldn't talk to the FBI, but she kept her mouth shut all the time.
That's good.
And she could have got a sweetheart deal.
Oh, I'm sure.
She did. She was just on the other side of the law.
You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, she had keys to all the doors, so to speak, and safety deposit boxes, I guess. But yeah, she could have definitely
That's
probably
another
got
thing. I couldn't understand why he did it. But then I did understand it, because if he was in trouble, what are you going to do? Give the keys to Tony?
Yeah.
No. For all your money? That's like putting a fox in the hen house. But, you know, she ripped him off, but he never was broke.
Right.
I mean, he came out alive, had some cash. But when she went down to, I think it was San Diego or L.A., and she was with the bikers, it was like they used her. They just used her for the money.
Yeah.
And They hot shotted her.
Yeah.
They gave her an overdose when they were done with her.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Nobody ever got in trouble for it. Nobody ever really looked at it, cared about it.
Yeah, probably didn't.
It's like, these are low lice. What the heck? Another one gone.
And again, that kind of rings true to the name of your book. Like you
nobody
said,
cares.
Nobody cares. Yeah, and what you did about it. I think that was kind of the, a lot of times, maybe some of the police force, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but probably in the Chicago area, you know, and I'm sure New York too, is kind of, they're going to let these guys serve up their own justice for a, you know, is a way of looking at it.
A lot of times I used to hear cops say, another mob hit.
Yeah.
They're not working on it. The only people that worked on it was the FBI.
Right. So now going back in Chicago, you know, we glossed over, you got in, you know, with the FBI and you were a CI basically. And then you eventually wound up getting out of that. What did you say? Like 82, 83?
No, September 15th, 1988.
Oh, 88. Okay. All right. So, I mean, what did you do at that point? Because you're out of there. Obviously you probably don't want to hang around Chicago much longer.
No, when they had, as soon as they got him cuffed, he was at my house.
Mm-hmm.
They had like maybe six or eight agents in my home. They were hiding in the closets. They were upstairs in my bedroom and they were listening on intercoms that I had set up.
Right.
And they expected trouble. I didn't expect any trouble, but we had a relay system of him, me calling him. I used to tell somebody else to call him from a payphone and say, Red wants to see you. And it was early in the morning, like 6 a.m. in the morning. And I sent somebody to call him and they said, Red wants to see you. And he came down. And so he said, what's this all about? And everything, he was all upset. And I said, well, I just wanted to give you some money because I'm going out of town for a while. And he said, oh man, why'd you do that? I'd taken it on my kick. You know, he said, you didn't need to give me no money. He said, I know you're good for it. And I said, he said, you made me come down here for all the way down here for that. And I said, well, I want to be right with everybody. And so at that point, when he left, they wanted to see if he had a weapon in the car. So in order to do that, they watched him till he walked to a Jeep that was in somebody else's name. He never drove a vehicle in his name.
Right.
But when I went to the, this was all being recorded. When I went to the tape to turn it off, I looked at it, and one of his favorite sayings is when he was done was case closed, Mo. He always used to say that, case closed. That means, you know, it's done. And I walked up to the camera and said, that's a wrap. Case closed, Mo.
Oh.
So he walked in the car or the Jeep, and the one agent, Jennings, Scott Jennings, came up on him and said, put your hands on the hood of the car. And he turned around with a very bad attitude, you know, fuck you. He's not going to do it. Right. And Jennings had to draw down him. He drew down on him. I said, put your hands on the car. And he says, you got a warrant. He says, yeah, I do. And he pulls it out. He looks at the warrant. And he had unlocked the door. So they checked the vehicle. There were no firearms in it. And he said, what's this all about? And he'd taken the money and put it in his shirt pocket that I gave him. Mm-hmm. He didn't take the envelope. He took it out of the envelope and put it in his shirt pocket. So they're patting him down. They got two guys right there now. There are two other guys. And Scott's patting him down. And he reaches in, he grabs the money. And he says, that's what this is about. And he looks at the money and he says, that all this is? I'll be out in 10 minutes. He still didn't realize it. Then he got down to the U.S. Attorney's office and they showed him one of the tapes. And as soon as they showed him one of the tapes, he said, I want my lawyer. I don't want to say anything. I want my lawyer.
Yeah.
So that night, or that happened in the morning. One of the agents had rented a hotel room downtown. And I had bought a house in Florida before this, like a year before this. I just didn't tell anybody. And that night or that afternoon, they handcuffed me. And we walked downstairs and I told all the employees, I said, you know, close up. And they didn't realize I'd sold everything in the building and everything else. The buildings were all sold. Everything was sold. And they just left. They were all afraid.
So you were prepped and ready to make your exit there when everything was done.
It was well executed because they took me in a car to a hotel. And in the car, I took the handcuffs off And when I got upstairs, the car was, the room was registered in one of the agent's names. So he told me, he said, just stay in the room. Don't mess around. Kick out in the middle of the morning, you know, for Florida. I had my car there. It was all ready. I had clothes down in Florida. Everything was all set. And he said, if you need anything, just have him bring it up to the room, room service, and sign my name. Just sign my name to it because it's on my credit card. And so I said, okay. And I did what I was told. And the next day I left. I think I left about 11 a.m. in the morning. And I run across the remnants of Hurricane Hugo on the way going down south.
Yeah.
And it was 1989.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Or 88, excuse me, 1988.
That's the last big one that kind of wrecked South Carolina there.
Yeah, well, I was coming through Kentucky, and there were trees down and rain, and it was very bad on the roads, and I lost my cell phone signal. We had cell phones. I had a cell phone that was on the console of the car.
Right.
So I used to pick it up, but it was going beep, beep, beep. I wouldn't get no signals. Mm-hmm. So they lost touch with me. They didn't know what happened to me for like 12 hours.
Oh, wow.
And they were kind of worried about me. You know, I didn't want a big parade taking me down anywhere. I felt that stealth was better than show.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even if they haven't figured it out by then, you know, you don't want to let them know any earlier because then they could maybe get word to somebody else. And then before you could get out of there, you know, that could spell some trouble for you. But you definitely sound like you had your ducks in a row and everything in line to go ahead and get out of there.
The FBI kind of got crazy about it because they thought of me as a prima donna. Because I wouldn't go with their rules. I just said, no, this is a better way to do it. And that's the way I did it.
Right.
And they didn't like some of the ideas. Like when I got out of touch from the hurricane,
mm-hmm.
or the bad weather from the hurricane, whatever, tropical storm, it bothered them a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, they thought something happened to me. And I figured I was safe, you know. I'm driving along my Lincoln on the way to Florida. You know, that was a heavy car. I'm worried about it.
So now I think a lot of people, when you talk mob and La Cosa Nostra and stuff like that, they focus a lot on New York, which I mean, New York definitely, you know, has earned that spotlight with certain things. A lot of people kind of gloss over Chicago, and I'm not sure why, because there's some heavy hitters that have come out of Chicago. I mean, you got Tony Accardo, Sam Giancana, you know, like you were talking, Mad Sam DiStefano, Tony Spilotra and Frank Rosenthal that we talked about earlier. I mean, those are some tough guys that come out of Chicago down there.
Yeah, I talk about it in my book, though. I compare New York to Chicago. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if I'm doing this from memory right, it says, unlike New York families, that there were five families fighting over turf.
Right.
Chicago never fought over turf because they had everything west of the Mississippi.
Right.
If it was west of Chicago, it belonged to Chicago. Cleveland, that belonged to New York.
Right.
Detroit, it belonged to New York. But anything west of Chicago, and that's a lot of land. I mean, you got a lot of towns in there.
Right.
And you're talking about a lot of bookmakers, a lot of jukeboxes, a lot of everything. But New York couldn't do it. They couldn't go west. That was the agreement they made. Right. And the agreement was made because there was a bill on gambling in New Jersey. Atlantic City, really. But it was in New Jersey. They put it to a vote. I think that was in 75. They put it to a vote. And then we knew this was coming beforehand. And it was either raise your property taxes or legalize gambling. So we knew it was going to go. Everybody knew it was going to go 2-3 years before it happened. So they cut a deal with the powers that be in New York, the commissioner, whatever,
right,
and said, we won't go into Atlantic City. But you won't come out to Vegas and you won't touch any of our stuff west of, you know, Chicago.
Okay. Yeah. That breaks it down a little bit. Cause Sam Giancana,
they're all fighting with each other in New York. They're fighting, killing each other. It was blood feuds and everything over, you know, small territories.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of the Colombo wars they had going on, them things were legendary.
Oh, the banana war.
Yeah.
The bananas war, they call it, or something like that.
Right.
Joe,
now Sam Giancana, he was a very interesting character. Now, did you get to meet him at all, or you never did meet him personally?
No. He was way up on the food chain. I was on the bottom of the food chain. Yeah.
Right. Now, and I think we talked in our first episode, he was actually not necessarily brought in, but he was up under Al Capone when Al Capone started out there. He was a gunman for Al. But later on, he was involved in quite a bit. And when I say quite a bit, I mean, you can tie him. There's reports of him tied to the Kennedy assassination. There's reports of him tied to Marilyn Monroe, you know, plots to assassinate Castro in Cuba. He was tied in with a lot of stuff, even dealing with the government at one point in time.
Well, that was through Bob Mayhew, who was former director of CIA.
Right.
That he worked for Howard Hughes.
Yes.
And he approached Johnny Roselli, and Johnny Roselli approached Sam Giancana. And they were both killed within like 8 months of each other, just before the commission or the Senate hearings. They both testified once before, and they brought him back for a second testimony. Right. And somebody didn't want him, they wanted to make sure he didn't testify again.
Right. Now Bobby Kennedy, which was John's brother, there's a famous clip that you can get where he's antagonizing Sam in the, what is that? Is that the Kefauver hearing? Is that what that is?
Or
is
Kefauver
that Kefauver hearing? Yeah. He's telling him, you know, I thought only little girls made giggles like that. Mr. G, you could, I bet Sam wanted to get up and just tear his head off right there in the courtroom.
Sam had a bad temper, a real bad temper. He used to fly off on people real bad. There's some wiretaps out there of him years ago where, I forget which guy, it might've been Chuck English. I don't know who it was, but they were over in Europe and they were looking at the Greek ruins over in Europe. They were interested in architecture. And he kept saying, you ought to see what this is like, Sam. I love it. You know, this and that. And he said, I got FBI up the ass and you're talking about, you're talking about these Greek ruins. Are you nuts? Get your ass back over here.
So now what do you think his role was in the Kennedy assassination with that whole thing? Because I know in some of the movies, it's him and they met with Carlos Marcello from out there. He was in Louisiana, right?
No. Carlos was from New Orleans.
Yeah. I mean, is that kind of true to form of what the movies have portrayed, or what do you know about that?
What do I know? All I know is by putting pieces together and making an educated guess. I really don't know.
Right. What's your educated guess?
Oh, he was involved in it.
Yeah,
he definitely was involved in it because all the guys used to talk about it. I mean, everybody used to talk about it.
Because from what I'm, like you said, I'm obviously wasn't there, and I'm piecing stuff together that I know. Kennedy was elected, and Chicago was actually a big deciding state when he won the presidency.
Not only that, West Virginia, all the Union states, they went down and grabbed all the Union states. They made everybody vote twice.
Right. Yeah. And it kind of had people there to make sure that things went the way they wanted it to go. And they were kind of under the impression that if Kennedy got an office, he was going to back off of them a little bit.
They were told that.
Right.
They were told that. Joe Kennedy turned on
them. Right. And then because go ahead.
Jack Kennedy did not do anything without his father's advice.
Right.
So
once he got in there and Bobby took over as attorney general,
his brother in like a rattlesnake, like a cobra, right, to go after all the mob.
Right.
And if it wasn't for Bobby Kennedy, they would never have RICO.
Exactly. That's what I was getting to. The RICO is what basically crippled the mob.
It's my opinion and only my opinion that what the politicians were doing was trying to put the mob out of business so they would control all the things and tax it, make it legal.
Right.
And over my over a period of time, I've watched it. The lottery.
Running
no
numbers.
No more numbers racket.
Running numbers, yeah.
Riverboat gambling. Gambling. I'm sure you have it where you're at. They got it everywhere.
Yeah.
There's gambling everywhere now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything, they kind of killed it.
Right.
They killed him off. Oh. It took him a long time. It took him almost half a century to do it, but they did it.
Yeah, you're spot on with that. It just seems like now, and I mean, even in lieu of these like these checks cashing places that charge these crazy interest rates, that's no different than Shylocking. Yeah, that was juice loans. Yeah,
so that was juice loans.
So it's everything that went on the street and behind closed doors is now basically done out in the open in front of everybody because it's taxed.
24% interest on your money, and you can go and you don't have to. You sign over your paycheck. You can give the deed to your house
right
as collateral. you don't have to have credit with the bank. They have big signs that said, no bad credit, come here.
Yeah. Now, another thing, too, I mean, people often say, and I've often heard this, is the Kennedys, you could almost refer to them to the Six family because of everything that they were involved in. Now, we'll touch on Marilyn Monroe here for a second, and I know a lot of people probably know her story. Her death has always kind of been, you know, a little bit of conspiracy theories being thrown around. What I've heard, and I've seen an interview with a cop that said that he pulled over Bobby Kennedy the night of Marilyn Monroe's death.
Now, what was on 101.
Okay. All right. So from the beginning here, I guess, of that all taking place, what do you know to be true?
I only know what Frank told me, Frank Schweiss.
Okay.
He was there.
Okay.
But he said there were a lot of people there. The Secret Service was there. CIA was there. There were a lot of people there. And I'm assuming that because he never gave up till the day he died, he was never convicted of murder, even though he was in prison. I'm assuming he never gave up anybody else. And they always said, oh, he could open the door to everything. You know, he'd give us a lot of secrets. He never did. He died wherever he had. So I'm assuming that what he said was, he made some references to me about things that happened in Florida, that involved a government agency. And they used to give him tips that there'd be a dope deal going down somewhere. And if it was on the beach, he'd go down, he'd kill the Colombians, take their dope, send it to Chicago, and keep the money.
Wow.
He told me how to send it back. He said, make sure you send it to FedEx. Make sure it's overnight. Make sure that, because they won't check the packages. He was telling me all these different things. And he's telling me it's on videotape. It's being videotaped. I'm like, really?
Yeah, because I know from what, like I said, the stuff that I've seen, that Marilyn had basically kind of had enough. And she was getting to run around by, at that time, Bobby and John.
Well, she got passed around to so many people. Sam Giancana.
Yeah.
I mean, you could name, she was going with like 8 people at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she made her own mess. You know, it was a mess. And I guess she was smitten with the president. And then his brother stepped in. And then Peter Lawford stepped in. And everybody else stepped in. And so all of a sudden, they didn't want to have anything to do with her. His father told him, you better cut this stuff out to JFK.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you're making too much, it's not going to work. So she was told at the White House desk, he's not taking any calls from you anymore. And Bobby, being attorney general, he went out to kind of smooth her down because he'd been involved with her too. Everybody wanted a piece of Maryland,
yeah,
but they didn't want to pay the price. So the bottom line was, I was talking to John Toohey on a, like we're doing, podcast or whatever. This is not a podcast. What do we call it?
It could be, you could consider, we've uploaded to YouTube, but it's going to be on podcast platforms. So okay. Interview podcast.
When I was talking to John Toohey, he had a lot of information. He's a good researcher, very good researcher. And his information matched my information. And I was talking about the wiretaps that were in the house. And the wiretaps that were in the house were not just a wiretap that they were set up on the phone, but even if the phone was hung up, it was a listening device. So if you had a phone in this room and a phone in that room, and he said he saw the house, he showed me pictures of it actually while we were doing the podcast. And he said, this is what it looked like, because in the old days, they didn't have electronic devices. They ran wires to everything. So when they took the house apart, there was like spaghetti everywhere. It was all over the place. But everybody had her wired.
Yeah.
And she had told her press secretary that's a fact. These are facts. Mm-hmm. She told her press secretary that she wanted to do a press release. And didn't say what it was about. But everybody else knew that was listening to her phone calls. And she was extremely depressed. And I guess 2 or 3 different factions jumped into action right away. And from what I understand, I think we covered this.
We spoke about it on the phone. We haven't covered it on here.
Bobby showed up. Bobby Kennedy showed up with Peter Glawford.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his helicopter. He had a helicopter helipad on his home in California.
Right.
And he showed up, and it was north of there. And I think it was Malibu, if I'm not mistaken. But I might be. He showed up, and he had a doctor. And they gave her a shot to sedate her, mm-hmm. calm her down, because she was screaming. I mean, she was upset. She was angry. And she was also, I believe she was bipolar. I really do.
I think so. It's probably a very good chance from what
they
I've seen.
They didn't diagnose those in back in those days.
Yeah, back all. In those days, yeah. They gave you a pill.
1962 guy.
Yeah.
But she'd been in and out of a couple of mental health institutions.
Right. I think DiMaggio got her out of one.
That was one for drugs. Mm-hmm. She was on different uppers and downers and whatever. She was a perfectionist. She had OCD and what do they call it? Attention deficit syndrome.
Yep.
ADD. Yeah. She had that too. So she was a perfectionist on everything that she did. And the drugs kind of helped her make it through life. Mm-hmm. But she'd been on drugs since she was like 17, 18 years old.
Yeah.
And that's not really publicized because she was a movie star.
Right. So you were saying, we got off on Joe DiMaggio there, but you said that it was Kennedy, Peter Lawford, and who else was there?
There were a couple of Secret Service agents there.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of people that I believe were CIA there. Okay. And they were kind of taking care of things the way they thought they should be taken care of. And they left when they thought she was calmed down and everything else. Mm-hmm. And contrary to public opinion or things that have been written about her, it wasn't in her room that all this happened. It was in the guest house in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved her back to her bed, left her completely naked on the bed with an open bottle of pills, barbiturates.
Mm-hmm.
And the barbiturates that were in her stomach weren't dissolved. So they pumped the stomach and they said, oh, it's an overdose. But the actual autopsy, Joe DiMaggio had an autopsy done after that. Yeah. After he exhumed the body.
Secondary autopsy, yeah.
Yes. But that was a couple of years later. And he exhumed the body. And they found chloral hydrate in her system. And that's what I was told that she ingested.
Wow.
So it's just one of those kind of things where it was a good plan, I guess, but for a bad reason.
Yeah, you're playing with fire there, no doubt about it. When not only you're dealing with the mob, you know, you're dealing with Sam Giancana, you're dealing with the president, you're dealing with the president's brother. I mean, that's a lot of important people that stand to probably lose a lot if you come out and start talking.
And Peter Lawford, who was a friend of Sinatra's and the Rat Pack.
Right.
So he was like very much in the Hollywood business, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I know she had dealt with Sinatra too. She used to stay at his place out there. What was it? Cal Neva.
Yeah. Well, that was a partnership. The Cal Neva was a partnership between Dean Martin. A lot of people invested money in it, but they pulled their money out when the mob came in.
Yeah.
When the mob came in, they pulled their money out and said no.
Because that was a good spot for some of the people to go in, but not necessarily be seen talking, because I think we had spoke about this also, but they had a bunch of like underground passageways and stuff where people could get from one room to the other in there, right?
Yes, they did. But one of the unusual things about the Cal Neva was the reason it was named Cal Neva was because half of the building was in California where there's no gambling.
Right.
Half of the building was in Nevada where there is gambling. So the original, in the very beginning, they got denied a license, a gambling license.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, Sinatra got the license.
Yeah, I did. I read that in the beginning. Yeah, he did get denied the license, but he wound up getting it later on.
I watched the hearing on his license when he went for it the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a joke. He said, no, I never knew these guys. I was never involved with anybody. They showed him pictures with his arm over Carlo Gambino.
Yeah.
You know, where they're
that hanging. Famous
he
picture.
Said, a lot of people like do photo ops with me. I used to go back. My agent told me to go back and you know, do a photo op with these people. But I never knew them. I never really talked to them.
Now, later on, when was that Giancana, he kind of got exiled from the mob there. When was that?
Actually, that was about 1966.
Okay.
Because he was drawing too much heat.
Right. Yeah. He was drawing a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah. Bill Romer was all over. I knew Bill. I knew Bill after that. You know, and Bill told me there's some, they used to lockstep him. I don't know if you're Operation Lockstep. It's where you have one car that follows.
Yep.
And another car on another street. And all they do is radio each other. The other one takes over. And they had 15, 16 cars lockstepping.
Wow. And he moved. Didn't he go out of the country for a little bit? Did he go to, was it Mexico or somewhere?
He went to Mexico and got a beautiful villa down there.
Yeah.
And started doing his own gambling in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to Iran, and he opened up a couple of casinos in Iran. He was making big money. Wow. I mean, it was just like, he didn't need anything from Chicago.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, he was like, I don't need you. You got rid of me? Fine. I'm here.
Yeah.
Well, then all of a sudden something happened. I don't know what it was. I only guess what it was. But he was brought back into the United States. The Mexicans turned on him because he was paying them for protection for the villa and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned on him and they brought him to the airport in pajamas. They brought him there in his pajamas. They just dragged him out of bed and brought him there in his pajamas. And he didn't even really, he had a coat on, an overcoat. But there's a picture of it, or there's a, I think there's a video of it on YouTube where he meets him at the airport, O'Hare Airport.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Romer met him at the airport. And he said, you know, we're working, he leaned over to Bill Romer and he says, you know, we're both working on the same team. And Bill Romer didn't know what he meant. He didn't know that. He didn't know, because he didn't know what, they're so secret. You don't know. One hand right. doesn't know what the other hand's doing. So he didn't understand that, but he started cussing him out and all kinds of stuff. Romer, he started cussing Romer out, and Romer says to Big, you know, there's, he's a celebrity. Everybody's looking at him, and he says, "See all you people coming through, you know, from O'Hare was a big hub."
Right.
And he said, "All you people coming through here, see this piece of scum?" He said, "We have to live with that."
Yeah.
And that was it. He walked away from that session. He told Romer at the time publicly. He told him, he said, you lit a fire that you can't put out.
Yep, that'll never go out. I remember seeing that one of the documentaries I was watching. I remember him saying he confronted him right there in the middle. Yeah, right there in the middle of O'Hara Airport. Now later on, Sam would actually, he would get his expiration date. And well, that was his own kitchen, right, while he was cooking dinner?
It was in the basement, like their little kitchen in the basement.
But now,
the old Italian homes, a lot of times they had a kitchen upstairs that they really didn't use.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't use the living room with the plastic furniture. They had plastic on the furniture. But downstairs was where you could, like, relax. So they had a kitchen downstairs. They had a family room down there, like a party room. It was where all the get-togethers were. And there was tables down there. So, and there was a little kitchen table off in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the table set for two people. So he was expecting a guest while he's cooking peppers and sausage.
Right.
Which is an Italian dish. You'd assume it's Italian. He just had a big get together at his house.
Right.
And he's down in the basement, and all of a sudden, I think his houseman called the police, and they took pictures of it. But whoever it was, the back door was open in the basement. And there were steps going up.
Right.
That left, you know, from the house. There were cement steps that went down to the basement.
Now, it's often been, I guess, when you say conspiracy theory or whatever, that it was Butch. What was his last name? Butch, what was his last name?
Blassie.
It's often
recently, Adam Flowers.
Right.
It wasn't Adam Flowers. Who was it? Somebody did a YouTube. Anthony Martini.
Yeah, Martini. I was about to say, I think that was who you said.
With his daughter.
Giancana's daughter.
She believes that it was a CIA agent, and they actually went into the basement and waited for him to come down.
Wow.
And they were in one of the little rooms off to the side just waiting for him. That's what she believes.
And it could be, I don't think Sam.
Nobody really knows.
Right. I don't think Sam would have ever talked. I don't think he was made like that.
No.
He would have went, he would have took his pinch. He would have done the time. I don't think you would have ever had to worry about him talking.
Well, he was a loudmouth, but I don't think he'd, I don't think he would have given up anybody. I don't think it was, even though he was sick and he was older and he just had surgery.
Right.
I don't think he's the kind of guy, probably like Schweiss, he would have gone to the grave.
Now, at that time, was Accardo the top guy? Was that about that timeline there?
75, he wasn't really. Well, he was always there as a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but.
Consigliere, yeah.
I don't know who was running the streets of 75. Ayupa was. Ayupa was running the streets of 75.
Okay. Now, Joe Batters, you know, also Tony Accardo, he'd never done a whole lot of prison time, I don't think.
He never did one day in jail. Not one day.
Now, that's impressive to be in that life for as long as he was and to have a nickname like Joe Batters. You can probably guess where that came from and the reasons they got that name.
Well, a lot of people know where it came from because I used to talk to some of the old timers that were around when he was around. He was very aggressive and he wanted to climb to the top, but he honed his skills with a baseball bat when he was a Louisville slugger when he was probably 22, 23 years old. Mm-hmm. He just bashed somebody's head. Wow. That's all. He killed him with a baseball bat.
Wow. Now, we were talking earlier. I was mentioning to you about a show I used to watch back in the day. It was called Masterminds, and it was about a jewelry heist down there in Chicago. And kind of the backstory was it was a detective from the Chicago police force, and he had since retired, and I guess he hooked up with a crew, and they started planning this well in advance. It was at a specific hotel. I can't remember the name of the hotel because it's been probably 15 years since I've seen this show.
But I saw it too.
But they knew that they were going to have this jewelry show in this hotel on this certain date. So they started going in there, all the crew, they would get a room and they would get a safety deposit box. And back then they didn't have them in the room. They had them in one area, all the safety deposit boxes in one area.
It was actually behind the desk.
Yes, behind the desk. So every time they would go in, they would get a key and then they would copy the key. And they'd done this to as many times as it took for them to have a copy of every key they had in the hotel.
It took them about a year.
Yeah, that's what I remember reading. It took them about a year. And then on the night of the heist, you know, all the jewelers and everything put the stuff in there and either they went out or went to bed or whatever. And they actually had a lady from the reports I've seen, a lady was who came in with a suitcase and just cleaned it all out. Now, they eventually wound up getting caught. You know, it usually winds up this way. One of the guys pissed one of the women off and she seen some of the jewelry and wanted it. And the guy told her no. And she phoned up the FBI or the local police or definitely some authority figure, and they all went down for it. But you were telling me about another one that happened up there, the Purolator robbery.
Yeah, that was something else. I always keep a radio on the car.
Right.
I like something in the background. And I was in Chicago. I always kept the radio because sometimes 90% of the time I was driving alone. I was alone. And so I'm listening to radio and they said, now this was cashed. It wasn't taken from the truck, but they called it the Purolator heist. Mm-hmm. And there was an inside man on the job. They kind of guessed that from the beginning.
It usually is.
But what happened was I heard it on the radio. And I was driving on North Avenue. I was going east. And I was going to pick up Kurt Hansen. Mm-hmm. And he was an outfit hitman that worked for Jimmy Couture. Mm-hmm. And that's where I first, you'll see in the book when you read the book. That's how I first got, my first in was him. But anyway, he introduced me to everybody. But along the way, what happened was I was going to American Bonding. That's where everybody hung out before the spot, mm-hmm. which is over at Grand and Ogden. But when I got there, there was nobody in the office. Nobody was there. And I looked at the parking lot and I figured, well, I'll park the car. But I always told the car hiker there, I didn't want him parking my car because I didn't want to bury it someplace. I didn't want to give him the keys, really. So I went up to the, it was like a mobile home office, and it had several steps going up. And I opened up the door, walked in, and there's this long table, and they got bags of money. They're just got, it's all over the table. And I looked down at the end of the table, it was Marshall Capano. And so when I saw Marshall there, I just, we never made eye contact. But he saw me and I saw him, and I just backed up, pushed down the steps. And Kurt, who was with me, like many other big tough guys, turned around and said, "We're dead." And I said, "I don't think so. I don't think anything's going to happen." He said, "No, they're going to kill us for sure. We walked in on something we shouldn't have walked in on." And it was never, later on, I talked to Marshall about it, but it was never really, nobody ever retaliated or anything else, because I never reported to the FBI.
Right.
I didn't report to the FBI.
Now,
it didn't involve a murder. It didn't involve a murder.
Right.
I was more interested in murders than I was anything else.
Right. Now, in our first sit down, we spoke about Alan Dorfman. And what a lot of people, I'm not sure, I know we had some technical difficulties, so I'm not sure if that one was able to come through pretty clear, but we'll just kind of gloss over it. He had a lot to do with the Teamsters and the pension funds there, right? He was the one that kind of gave out the loans to build some of these casinos.
He was, secretary or whatever. He was the head of the pension board loan committee.
Right.
And even before Hoffa disappeared, Hoffa put him there.
Right. And that's kind of what I was.
He was still part of that.
Yeah.
But Jimmy Hoffa used to tell him who to make loans to and who not to make loans to. Now, with him gone, he was in charge of the whole thing up there.
Right.
And Joey was up there with him every day. They wiretapped that office and they knew exactly what was going on.
And that's actually who I was trying to circle to was Hoffa, because I know a lot of people relate Hoffa with the Teamsters and, you know, being involved with the mob and things like that. Have you watched, or which I'm sure you have, The Irishman?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what do you think of how that they wound that up?
Well, it's not accurate.
Not accurate?
It's not accurate at all. I don't believe in Sherman. You know, I don't believe their story at all.
So you don't think Sherman pulled the trigger?
I think it's Hollywood.
Yeah, I'd actually read his book, I Heard You Paint Houses, a while before The Irishman ever came out.
I did too.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what was said.
Right.
Because I said, whoa, something I didn't know.
And there's been other people, I won't name names, but there's other people on YouTube that said their opinion. They said he's somewhere wet. And, you know, obviously nobody knows. It's probably one of the, I guess, the best kept secrets of that whole time period right there, because nobody's ever found out. They've said he's in Giant Stadium in the Meadowlands. You know, there's been all types of, I guess, conspiracy theories about that too. What is the best, if your best guess, what do you think is probably more true to form of what happened?
I think he was put in that waste management dump out in Jersey. And, you know, they got bulldozers and everything else. He's probably buried maybe 40, 50 feet down.
So do you think he was killed in Jersey, or was he killed in Detroit?
I think he was moved after he was killed.
Okay, because I want to say, I think that it's been confirmed that they found DNA, what, in a house and in a car?
They did.
Yeah.
And it's in one spot, I thought maybe their theory about putting in the crematorium was pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Because it would have made a lot of sense to have a house that was down the street from a crematorium not far away.
Exactly.
Just have a tarp laying there and somebody walks in, pop them, roll up the tarp, throw them in the crematorium, and there's nothing left.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely makes sense.
Well, there's no proof to it. There's no proof of anything.
Exactly.
But there's been a lot of deathbed testimonies about a lot of things that happened that they weren't true.
Yeah, they say that Frank puts a lot of stuff done as courtesy him that ain't necessarily accurate. I mean, he claims to have killed Joey Gallo too, right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure he claimed to have hit Gallo as well. And a lot of people said that that wasn't accurate either.
The whole thing just didn't look right to me. The way that Joe Pesci's part, De Niro's part, mm-hmm. It didn't click in my head. Like it was entertainment.
Yeah. I thought Pesci played it well. They got him out of retirement for that movie. I thought he played it well.
Speaking of movies, do you know what I watched last night?
What's that?
the movie that you were talking about, and I never did see it. It was Capone. It was made in 2020.
Yeah, with Tom Hardy.
Yeah, and it was really crazy. He's got a golden machine gun. That is the craziest movie I ever saw. There's no accuracy in it whatsoever.
Yeah, that's, and a lot of that, I think a lot of people were excited because they seen Capone and they were thinking they were going to see something, you know, that's more or less just about when he was losing his mind, you know, that whole movie.
He lost it already.
Yeah.
That's why they didn't keep him in Alcatraz.
Right.
They sent him home because they said, what's, you know, this guy, he's not going to harm anything. He's catching butterflies, you know.
And that's what, that was what, undiagnosed syphilis or something like that, or untreated?
No, it was untreated. He got it in like 19, I think when he was a young kid, he got it. But it lay dormant in his system for like maybe 15, 20 years. And by the time he got a sore in his genital area,
right,
he really didn't go to the doctor and take care of it. So when he went into prison, it was really, he had all kinds of different sores on him and stuff like that. The doctors really didn't do too much for him. I mean, Alcatraz was built for him.
Right.
I mean, J. Edgar Hoover wanted it built for him. He was in Atlanta before that. But that whole thing was, it was crazy. And the sulfa drugs they tried on it was too far gone. It had riddled his body.
Now, a few years ago, well, I guess it's probably been about 7 years ago, me and the family took a trip up to Philadelphia, and there was a prison that he was in up there in Philadelphia. I think it's Eastern State Penitentiary. I used to have a postcard I bought from, I don't know where it's at.
I don't know.
It was in Philadelphia. It had his room set up in there just like it was when he was there. It had a huge red chair. He was like one of the only prisoners in there with a telephone and all that. And
that's the way it was in Atlanta. And when they found out, because he used to buy the wardens.
Right.
And when they found out, that's when J. Edgar Hoover said, no, we're going to build something on an island that's really, you know, and he was moved to a little tiny cell and treated just like everybody else. And there was no talking.
Right.
Alcatraz had a rule, no talking.
Wow.
Talking, you go to the hole.
Yeah,
and the hole was a dungeon.
Yeah, me and my daughter toured that prison, and it was quite creepy even in the daytime. And from what I understand, I wouldn't mind going back. They actually, at nighttime around the months of October and probably September as well, they turn it into like kind of a haunted house type deal when you're walking through it. And that, I imagine that'd probably be something, definitely an experience if anybody's into that. But yeah, it was definitely a different from any cell
that
was in there.
Was that Lewisburg?
No, I think that was Eastern State Penitentiary. It was in Philly.
Okay.
It was in downtown Philly.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's Eastern State Penitentiary.
Why they moved him there.
I don't know how long he spent there. It was just when you walked by it, it said the cell that was, you know, stayed in by Al Capone. It had it all set. He had like a desk, now, nice desk, typewriter.
Prison. He was in prison in Philadelphia. He went, according to history, he went down there to go to prison and got arrested for carrying a firearm in the city limits or something like that. And the judge gave him time. And so he went into a state penitentiary there.
That might have been it, yeah.
And I think he did like 8 months or something like that, and then he left.
Yeah, Al Capone cell and Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site, yeah.
So it's Eastern State Penitentiary.
Yeah, Eastern State Penitentiary. Got a glimpse of Al Capone's cell where he lived at, yeah. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. I saw the picture of that thing.
Yeah, it's a real famous picture.
I looked at it and said, wow.
Yeah, I'll probably tag it. I might see if I can put it in the show notes on this show for people to see it. It's definitely different than every other cell that people had to inhabit in there. I can promise you that. He definitely had some comfortable digs.
Well, I know a lot of people that had that. Sam Giancana had that when he was at Cook County Jail.
Right.
When he was at Cook County Jail back in... it's when he took, they offered immunity he took the Fifth Amendment, mm-hmm. and they offered immunity, so he wouldn't have the Fifth Amendment. He right. still, they got him for contempt of court. They put him in Cook County Jail for a year.
Yeah.
And while he was in jail, it was a joke because he owned the sheriff, the warden, everybody else in jail. So what he did was they took out bars and they made several cells and he had drapes all around it. He had his own bed brought in. I mean, it was like a hotel room.
Yeah.
He had his own phone right there. He had a telephone right there. All you have to do is pick it up and dial out. He had his own meals cooked for him. They had special stuff brought in. Frank Colletta used to talk about that. He said, don't know. He said that he was his main guy there. That he used to get him things through the guards and whatever. He was his in between man.
Well, they dab on that a little bit in the Goodfellas movie when all of them have to go into prison and do time. They said
it's that way in small in state prisons. Yeah. It's like that. Federal prisons, I don't think it is.
Right. It's totally exiled from the rest of the prisoners. They're living, you know, together, like you said, kind of almost like in a dorm, so to speak.
Well, it's a pod of their own.
Yeah, yeah.
The Goodfellas, it shows them like in a pod of their own, where they had a hot plate pan. They used to cook their own foods or whatever.
Now, and I just recently learned there's a famous, infamous, might be the better word, a serial killer from around the South Carolina area. His name was Pee Wee Gaskins. And he killed a lot of people around the Carolina areas. And his book is very rare. It's hard to find. It's even out of print now. I've actually got one. And it's called The Final Truth, the Autobiography of a Serial Killer. It's almost impossible to find in print. And when he went to jail many a times, but one time he had to do some time in Atlanta and he was in there and he was actually somehow or another got tied up with Frank Costello. And Frank had got word of how brutal he was and what he did. And Frank kind of gave him some talking to him. He was like, look, he's like, if you're in here for murder, he's like, what you need to learn is if there's no body, there's no charge. And after he got out, it kind of became his MO once he would get these people and he would kill them. And I mean, it was just anybody. It wasn't specific to anybody. He would pitch up hitchhikers. It didn't matter. And then he had this marsh around the area that he would take them to and he would put them in that marsh and they would basically sink to the bottom of the marsh and they might be missing, but they never had no bodies that they could pin on them.
There were some people that I know of that use acid tanks.
Yep.
They had auto repair shops, and they had these big acid tanks that they would dig or they put in radiators for cars. When the old radiators weren't plastic, they were made out of metal. They'd take them in there and clean the cores out and everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of times a body got dumped in there. There were no bones left, nothing.
Wow.
That was it. There was nothing left. And at one point, I knew what was going on because one of the guys that worked at the sanitary district told me. Was they would open the gate, the back gate to the Metropolitan Sanitary District. Well, there was like five or six tanks there, but they weren't tanks. They were built like swimming pools. They were down level to the ground.
Right.
They went down about 20 feet. And in the first tank was acid. The second tank, which they pump it through to the next tank, all sludge and sewage went in there, Metropolitan Sanitary District.
Right.
They'd move everything over there to the second tank and do the same thing with it, you know, and they cleaned out the third tank, fourth tank. By the time you got down to the end, they pumped out powder, sludge, and they put it in big piles, let it dry out, and they sold it from Milorganite to the people downstate in Illinois to grow their crops. And they were doing real good with that for years. Well, it's huge tanks. I mean, these are bigger than Olympic-sized swimming pools. They're huge.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it and saying, my grandfather worked there. And so I was looking at it and saying, there's no way you'd ever find a body. Because even going through to the next tank, there was like an auger to chop things up, you know. So if something was in that tank, it's gone.
Yeah, and that became kind of a mainstay with the mob there. If there wasn't any body, it was hard to build a case.
Their other thing was, in Chicago, was advertising. If you pop somebody, you put them in the trunk of a car and park the car where they're going to find it like 8 months later.
Right. Wow.
But they were advertising. That was advertising, you know, that somebody did something that they shouldn't do.
Right.
Chicago was big on that.
Yeah.
They're big on advertising. I mean, they'd throw people in the trunk of a car and maybe 4 or 5 days later, they find the car. But when they did, it was a message to all the other people that were cheating or doing something to them.
Yeah.
Watch yourself.
Yeah.
Because we're watching you. And this is could be your fate.
Yeah. You could end up in this car too the next time somebody finds it sitting there.
Oh, it'd be your own car.
Yeah. Wow, man. Well, we're closing in on an hour here. We appreciate you sitting in with us here on Crime and Entertainment. Again, like I said, if any of you is interested in Red's book, You can go, like I said, it is available on Amazon, but you can also go to his website. It's redwemet.com.
Yes.
Okay. And then
and
he
don't
will...
forget to hit the like button.
Yes.
Hit the like button and subscribe to Wade's channel.
Absolutely.
Wade's got a good channel here.
Yeah, we're trying to build some things up. We've got a lot of good guests coming down the pipe. And, you know, like I said in the first interview, I'd followed Red for the last couple of years and seen a lot of his YouTube videos and, you know, just reached out to him and kind of told him what I was doing. And he was gracious enough to help me out here. And I'm sure we're going to be back again with not too long because, this, like I said the other day, this man's got stories for days. So we want to get them all out there so you guys can hear them.
You know, I have to tell you something about that. I don't know if this is in the other broadcast or not. But that's what we call broadcasts instead of podcasts.
Yeah.
It's a broadcast. So anyway, I was thinking about this, and I thought probably the reason, I'm guessing, it's only a guess, that certain things went the way they did was because of fate. It wasn't planned. 90% of it wasn't planned. And for years, people told me that I was a great storyteller. And
as you are,
you asked me about why did I write a book. And I used to tell people all the time, I'm not an author. I'm not an author. And I'm a storyteller. I'll sit around and tell a story. And a lot of people get up, walk away and say, boy, that's a bunch of bull. You know, it's not true. And so later on, I became an author. But I wrote all my own words.
Right.
I didn't hire an author or a co-author to actually write my words for me. I did have somebody help me with it. Raymond, he helped me with it.
Now, is your book on Audible or no?
No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I just put it on Kindle 2 years ago.
Okay.
I kept it on just regular book. And a lot of people said, oh, it's not in Kindle. And now that it's in Kindle, guess what? It's like... maybe 3% of the people buy in Kindles.
Right. Yeah. I'm getting into the Audibles a little bit more. I used to have a lot more free time to read a lot of books. Nowadays, not so much, you know, free time, but a lot of times if I'm riding in the car, it's good. You can just listen to Audibles, you know, in the car. And, I'm actually about halfway through Handsome Johnny Roselli's book. I'm halfway through that. I've knocked out the one about, Scores, the strip club they had down there in New York City. It kind of got tied in with the Gambinos down there. I knocked out that one. It was pretty good. I hit Frank Collada's book. That's where I listened to that one. So
I listened to his Audible too.
Yeah.
They had his Audible for free.
Yeah.
It was on the internet and I just ran across it.
Yeah. Now, one of the last guys we interviewed was Mr. Brian O'Day. And Brian, you've seen a piece of his interview. He's kind of like you.
I watched the whole thing twice, guy.
Yeah.
I like.
Yeah, his book is on Audible, and when I was researching, I'd already had the book. I'd had it for years, and I went and looked at it the other day, and I seen it was on Audible, and I was hoping that it was going to be him reading that book, and it wasn't.
It's
it was somebody
not.
Else.
That's the problem. I couldn't read it. If I did an Audible, it'd probably take 15 takes to get it done, but I did research it one time. I talked to somebody, and I sent him over the internet. I sent him a copy of the transcript, the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was going to get back to me with samples. And he never did.
Wow.
He never did. So he was talking like $4,500 to read it and actually, you know, read the book. And I thought about that and said, that means I got to make that much back I got to sell some of his Audibles to even get it back.
Right.
And Audibles are cheaper than the book.
Yeah.
So
it'll take you longer. Yeah.
Is it worth it? No.
Yeah.
Not to me.
Nah.
If you're going to read it yourself, it's a whole different story, but I don't think I could do it.
Yeah.
Probably I'd have more emotion, like he said.
Well, yeah.
About it.
That was his key.
Put emotion into it and say, I could probably turn around and say, like, the price of a concrete floor. I need to put my cheaters on for this guy. After research for a month, Kurt finally came and found a place where I could rent a dump truck. But see, I'd be going,
Yeah.
I, you know, if I read it in my mind, it's not like reading it aloud.
Right.
And you'll find that out with a lot of people. They'll turn around and say, oh, yeah, I read it, but I can't read aloud.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I've heard people ask me, can you read me that? And they're going in between time. They're hesitating, whatever. That doesn't make for the emotions of it.
Yeah. Now, and you don't realize, especially after starting this podcast and going back and doing editing, it takes a lot of work to not say the uhs and the ahs and all that. It's a lot of work.
I even find myself doing it on this end because these are not scripted.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're off the cuff here.
So I'll go like, I'll wait for a second.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, most of the guys I interview, I kind of have a little guide that, want to break down, go step by step. I didn't have any scripts with you, but, and it was pretty easy because I know a lot about, Chicago and the mob movies. So it was, we just kind of went off the cuff here with you. And that's what I like about it. And like I said, I'm sure we're going to get there together and do it again here in the near future. But Red, we want to thank you for coming on Crime and Entertainment. This is now your second go round. I'm sure there'll be a third, probably a fourth and a fifth too.
That's good. Yes. That's okay, bud. Anytime, bud. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, you guys make sure, as Red said earlier, like us here on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, subscribe to the channel on YouTube, and this will be put out on about any platform that you listen to podcast on here in the coming weeks. So again, we want to thank everybody. This was Red We Met. I am Hollywood Wade, and we are out of time.
Well, by God, there you go. Red We Met Part 2. Edgar, that right there is just some info that, like you said earlier, you feel like you're probably not even supposed to be knowing. It's probably just holding your ears and saying, I'm not supposed to be hearing this.
That was the greatest kind of story.
Yeah, by halfway through,
let me turn it off.
You got it. You're on the edge of your seat, but you don't know whether you want to get up off of it and leave or just keep listening.
Hey, I'm closing the blinds right now to make sure nobody's looking in. Several other crime and entertainment in those stories.
This is where you get both of them, ladies and gentlemen, the crime and the entertainment portion. And that's what we like to try to do here. We like to bring these interesting stories, and we hope you all are enjoying it. We've got more people lined up. We've got some more interesting characters lined up, a few movie stars, some singers we've got lined up here. We got them coming up down the pipe, and it's going to be fantastic. So just make sure you guys are listening along, following us on all the social media apps, liking us on Facebook, following us on the Instagrams, checking out the YouTube channel. Most of the time we have our interviews like we did here. We'll upload the full Zoom interview for the YouTube channel, so you can go on and check that out if you're a more visual person as opposed to the podcast and you want to kind of see the interactions. You go on and do that. The last one we did last week with John Fiore was fantastic. Obviously, we went over, he was star of The Sopranos, and he was on Law and Order for a good minute. So
never heard of those shows.
Absolutely. just ones that got swept up under the rug there.
Has been. It never was. Never got on there with those.
We actually got another star from The Sopranos came in and done an interview with us, Robert Fornara. Now, he played Eugene Pontecorvo on the show Sopranos. So we had a fantastic interview. That's going to be coming out here in a few weeks. I don't really know how we're getting all these people. I promise you, I'm not holding a gun to anyone's head. I'm just asking, and they're obliging. That's how simple it is, folks. Go out there. You got to show them you want to put out a good product. That's the thing is, anybody can say, hey, I want to do a podcast, but they want to go and look at the body of work, as Ron Jaworski likes to say. What are you working with? What are you doing? Let's look at the body of work. What have you done so far? What are you bringing to the table? And that's what they want to see. Yeah.
You watch 500 hours of tape a week, as they used to joke about. But there's definitely something to it that happens up the show. And like I always say every episode, the show is so good. How are we on this? Does anybody know we're on it? Because we're on it. Is somebody going to report us?
It's definitely a head scratch.
These guys are making entertainment.
It's definitely a head scratcher. I had one of my pals call me the other day, and he's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm just watching a little football. He's like, I figured you'd probably be interviewing people, leaving all us small folks behind. No, that's not my style. I'm still the same old me. And in fact, what we want to do here, and I'm sure you agree, we want to dedicate this show to a friend of ours in our hometown, well, right next to our hometown. You and I grew up in Darlington, but in Florence is where all the partying went because there wasn't really any places to do it in Darlington. And a friend of ours tragically passed away last week, Mr. Chavis Thompson. Chavis was, I'm going to use this term and it would be accurate, a larger than life guy. He was a big guy. He actually was a bouncer at a lot of clubs. He kept things in order, so to speak, kept things on the up and up. And tragically, we lost him last week, way, way too early. And he was a fan of the show. We had just talked about a week before that happened. He was wanting to track down a Jaguars Trevor Lawrence jersey because, as you know, that man was a huge Clemson fan. And we just want to go and dedicate this week's show to him.
Absolutely. As, like I said, we met through Florence, South Carolina. I was trying to remember when I met James. I can't remember. It was like I always knew him. Guy had a heart of gold. Never heard him say a crossword about anybody, actually. Just one of those people. And how rare is that in this life? Never had a guy say anything bad about anybody else. I was just talking to him a week before he passed as well, also about football and playing Madden. And no, I did not be the last time I spoke with him. So.
Yeah,
whew, I mean, that was a big blow to the community right there.
And I was sitting there that Monday night, and I was watching, I think it was the Saints and the Jaguars were playing, and he crossed my mind. I was like, I bet he's watching this game. He said, I bet he's pissed because they were losing, in fact. The Jaguars are losing. So, you know, and then I never would have thought the next day I'd have woke up and then see posted, you know, he was no longer with us. So, you know, definitely thoughts and prayers out to his family from everybody over here at the Crime and Entertainment family. And like I said, we just want to dedicate this episode this week to him. And we wish nothing but the best for the rest of his family, prayers and healing for those guys. Girl, man, I think that about does it this week. I mean, that was, again, Red We Met Part 2. If you guys are interested in more of his story, we will have a link to go buy his book in our show notes. Again, if you go to his website and buy the book, he will actually send you a autographed copy. I've actually got my personal autographed copy here in my collection. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. Books obviously got a lot more information in this podcast, but we'll work to try to get it all out here. Maybe in a couple more episodes later on down the line, we're definitely going to have Red back.
Get more stories.
Oh, yes. Yes. Red's got stories. I think that man might even be in Vegas right now. I talked to him another week. He said, wait, if you don't hear from me for about a week, it's fine. I'm just in Vegas. I was like,
well, boy, that's got a lot of weight to it. Somebody goes out of Vegas, but Red knows so much stuff. I'm over here trying to tidy up my place, taking the trash out, get everything in order.
Red, ain't you in the black book down there? Like, oh, no, never mind. It was somebody else. Obviously a different place, different time than it was back when Red was dealing with some of the people that was down there. Now, you went, how long ago was it that you went down to Vegas?
2017.
As a big of gambling man as I am, I like to throw a buck or two down on a wager. I have never been to Las Vegas. Never.
We gotta change that, buddy. It is a great time. I had a friend, his father used to play some game that I still can't remember the name of, but he was going to Vegas for years. I would say maybe over 30, and he claims never had a bad time in Vegas. So you're going to find something that you like. If gambling's not your thing, there's something else. Take it from me, because I can't gamble or play any kind of card game. Horrible luck. Four-armed bandits took all 25 cents I put in there in a machine there in Vegas. But I found some other things to get into in that town, and I live to tell about it. But what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
I don't know what my luck would be like down there either. I remember a few years back, I did go to a casino boat, and this was that was probably about 20 years ago. It was a while ago. So I didn't have a lot of extra cash, so to speak. So I took about $300-$400 with me. You're supposed to be out there about 6 hours, but you can't gamble until it gets out into international waters. So it's about a 45-minute boat ride out there. I was out there with some friends of ours, Rodney and Casey Stone, and we're, you know, gambling, doing our thing, and I'm playing the blackjack. Before you know it, I think I'm about 25 minutes in, and I am shit out of money already. I got $0. Yeah, so I've got like 5.5 hours left, and I got to stay on this boat. So I go track down Rodney, and I bum a 20 from him until we get back. I had my buddy back at the room. That was just all it took on me on there. And I just went to those penny slots, like you mentioned, and just played those. That way I could get a free drink when the waitress walked by. You know,
I got to cook more water down to water.
Yeah. When you ain't got it like that in the money department, you got to do what you got to do. And I wasn't about to just sit there for 5.5 hours and watch everybody else gamble. At that point, I'd have just chose to jump off the damn boat and try to swim back to shore. So, I ain't the best swimmer either. So I just take that 20 and play them penny slots till we get back into town.
So you survived. That was your big casino type moment.
Yes, that was it.
So I got to say, you mentioned the international waters, and almost every CD level movie that comes up will have a plot line where, like, we're in international waters. You can do whatever you want, as if you can commit any crime and no one will ever say anything. This is not how the planet works. Just because you're in international waters isn't a get out of jail free card. Bring it back to the crime part of crime entertainment. So I just thought that was funny that you mentioned the international waters we can go gamble. So some people say that means there's no laws. It's like, no.
There's still laws out there.
That's how it works.
Yeah, anything you do out there that's illegal to the letter of the law in a certain way is still illegal when you get back across here.
Totally.
Gamble over there. That's about it. Good old robbery and things like that. That's still illegal, folks. It doesn't matter where you're at.
Still illegal. Murder's still illegal. I don't care what the B movies tell you. You don't just throw them in the water and go on with life. That's not how it works in international water.
All right, so that's folks. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. I am your host, Hollywood Wade. That was my co-host, Jaeger Yancey Cheddar. And unfortunately, we are out of time. Jaeger, close us out.
It'll be my honor to close out this show. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Again, if your servers and subscribe on the YouTube, follow us over on Twitter. Like us on the Facebook. I don't know what you do on TikTok. Are we there? We're coming soon as smoke signals. But join us next week on Crime and Entertainment.